spike scan initiated. I'm picking up a podcast arriving. Wait, designation, Forge the Narrative.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host, We All About Lost Souls Podcast. I'm joined by Tandy Gates.
Hey, everybody.
Red Powell and Adam Camilleri.
What up?
G'day.
Welcome to the show, everybody. Last week, we talked about the trials and tribulations of trying to put together an Eldari list. And the app is updated. So if you have the codex and you have your code and you put it in, you can, by the time you're hearing this, you can be clicking away in Battleforge, coming to the same conclusion that I have, that it is tough to get everything you want to get in into that list. And, you know, we'll talk more about that. But I did paint up a Lycus and show her off a little bit.
Very cool.
Well, and I'll point to where the challenge. So, okay, in this web of explosion, it's actually blowing apart the column that she's standing on. Mm-hmm. And so in the warp web, there are little pieces of Wraithstone that are in that. And I painted them all meticulously. And then, of course, I covered them up with the glowy effect of the thing. But, you know, sacrifices are made. And I think, you know, it does help with the effect that I was going for. The challenging parts, like the real challenging parts about this model, was the face, like getting the face that even resembles something that is, I don't know if you can see it in the camera or not, but you know, just for me, that was several tries of trying to get it to something that looked resembled like a facial type area. challenging model, but I loved it. And I am happy with the outcome and the different cool little textures and stuff that the model afforded the whoever paints this to mess with.
The colors, for some reason, remind me of like 1990s comic book characters or something like that. I think it's because it's like the black kind of lycra suit with all the different colors on top. I really like the high contrast color scheme you have.
Thank you.
Spawn.
Spawn, Venom, Spider-Man, Spawn. That area.
Yeah.
Or era.
Yeah.
I use contrast paint, Black Templar, on the armor. But, you know, great, really nice new sculpt. Really like the way it turned out. It did take a few tries, but you know, you got the time. It's your model. Do whatever you want with it. It's fun to do. Has to make it in the list. Did I show off Jane Zarr last week?
Look at that.
Yeah.
Very nice.
This has got a kind of a, I put a seal on this one, and I haven't dulled it back down yet. So pardon the shine on this. But this recently painted the newer model, and really looking forward to getting it in lists and wreaking some havoc. What's going to happen with those two characters, I believe. But we'll see how it goes. This week, want to talk a little bit about the Crusade.
Oh, snap.
The Nachman Gauntlet coming out. And Ray, this is like right up your alley.
It is. Well, and not only that, but I was pleasantly surprised to see that, I mean, right on the cover are Night Lords, which I've been really excited about. I mean, I think I mentioned, you know, I just played Night Lords in 30K at LVO, and I'm kind of building my Night Lords in 30K are kind of late era Crusade forces or Horus Heresy. So I'm mixing a lot of the stuff from the Nemesis Claw into and Chaos Space Marine bits into it. And then to see this pop up on the front of the Nachman Crusade, it's pretty exciting. And there's some really great stuff to it. Jumping into it, it's always been cool to see some of the Crusade and how Crusade has continued to develop over time. And I really think they made a bigger step with this kind of expansion or this Crusade season. So it's
maybe
really cool.
let's talk about what Crusade is, like defining Crusade for folks that might not be familiar with it as a mode of play for 40K.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, it is absolutely the a narrative way to approach 40K. Crusade, every codex, so there was Leviathan Crusade, and then they came out with Pariah Nexus Crusade, and now this Nachman. But it's essentially a way that you can play and you can level up units with a Crusade roster over time. There's a bookkeeping element to it, and as you play through, you gain experience, you level up, you gain traits or relics, and then you can keep playing. If you get taken out of battle, you can actually gain battle scars. And there's all these other little elements that they built in, and ranging from what has been provided in the installments that I just mentioned. You know, Leviathan had like a monster hunter thing going on, which is pretty cool. Pariah Nexus had a resource piece of trying to collect Blackstone. Every codex that you get has in the back of it has a Crusade section with thematic ways to kind of build out your roster. Space Marines have like a kind of like an oath of honor crusade that they can go through. One of the cool things with Space Marines, you can get a battle scar. There's one specifically where you become disgraced. And Space Marines have a cool way to go back and kind of like work their way back into, like they can redeem themselves. There's a redemption.
You make that scar cool again. You like put a,
right,
a cool little extra hook in it or a tattoo over it. Or
I mean, you could arguably, yeah, you could make your own redemption story for Titus. Right? Like you could legitimately make it and go through that of like you became disgraced and then you had to work your way back up to it. Stuff like that. So
seriously, you just get another purity seal, lick it, slap it on, you're good to go. Forehead, chin, under the armpit, doesn't matter where.
I wish it was that easy. Unfortunately, the battle scar for disgraced means you and if you're a leader, which in this case, you know, whatever unit you're attached to, you don't get to use any stratagems. So it's really, really exciting trying to work your way back from being disgraced like that.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but no, really cool stuff. Again, like and the White Dwarfs, they always put some cool stuff in the White Dwarfs. You know, there was one in a little while ago that was like how to play a Kroot mercenary army. It was Crusade rules for that, which was very cool, like a whole Kroot Crusade army. And then, of course, you know, this is all the kind of stuff that it plays into things like the Grand Narrative, for example, which uses the Crusade stuff. But I think it's also really important to state that while this stuff is all cool and it provides a lot of different ideas of how to do things, there are it's just a vehicle for enjoying the game in a different way, and it's not mandatory either. It's just good ideas of what you can do, but also not something you have to.
You also you mentioned bookkeeping like it was a negative. Like so, they're
sure
playing narratively. You can set up whatever scenario you want. That could be
that's right.
Your my forces are trying to break through, lay a siege to your forces on the other side of this giant wall. You're trying to intercept me as I'm trying to get off planet to the starship that's right off the table. You know, all kind of different stuff. What this introduces is a series of linked games telling a story that that goes beyond just one battle on the tabletop.
Correct. Yeah, it makes this versus, you know, competitively or at an event you go to, it's like a bunch of snapshots of different events where you could still have your own narrative and enjoy that with someone every step of the way. The Crusade system steps towards a different approach of playing multiple games where it does exactly what you just said. It links them together over time where the units progress from here to there to there.
Is you're assigning different traits to the units that either survived or maybe not done as well in the previous battle on those things. So it's this bookkeeping is adding to the story of your unit and personalizing and you know, the journey of, as it takes on different characteristics, campaign or series of story, the story arc or whatever you're calling it.
That's right. And you know, and Tanya, you mentioned it in the pre-show. It would be really great, just throwing it out there for anybody that may be listening, if the app could maybe have a... I would gladly throw down some extra bones for... the ability to track, like you know, have like a Crusade thing built into the app. If I could build my list and then I could then take it into Crusade and sit there and do that. I will say, you know, just shout out the Goonhammer team. I'm sure we're all, you know, plenty of people are familiar with their stuff. They have a administratum.net piece attached to all their Goonhammer business. It's used in the Grand Narrative. Or it's available for folks to use. It's not mandatory, but it helps facilitate a lot of that bookkeeping. You can take your list straight from the GW app. You can upload it. It'll put all your units into the roster. And then when you go in to play a game, just like you would in the battle app, You can essentially highlight which units from your roster are participating, and then you do a little bit at the end of the game, which says, you know, you killed this many or whatever, and this is the one that you mark for greatness, which is part of the process, and it'll keep track of all your experience for you, and then it'll even tell you when it's time to like level people up. It'll allow you to reward. So every mission typically has like a victor bonus. So if you win, like you get a relic or you get some kind of thing, it'll help keep track of all that, which is very cool. And you can tell that they put a lot of effort into that because they just like they do with the battle app and everything, they upload all the Crusade missions into it. So you can kind of easily work your way through it, which is admittedly, I've used it for several campaigns now. And I've found it to be extremely helpful. And again, it's just some of these little things that, you know, if the GW app were to step into that and do something like that too, I think that would be really helpful, especially being able to reference. Because you get this codex and, you know, the app has all of the data sheets and rules and updated, but there's also all this Crusade stuff in the back of every codex that could be cool to be able to kind of quick reference, kind of like in Kill Team, if y'all have seen the app. It just has like straight up like PDF pages you can flip through, which I think could be cool if every Crusade thing was just another thing you had in the app. But that, you know, enough of me wishlisting.
How do folks build lists for this? And then we can talk about some of the cool effects in the Nachman.
So you typically, depending on where you're going into it, you know, if you were to just go off straight Crusade, you essentially start with, and it's cool because you can do almost like an escalation piece, right? You can start with like 1,000. And then as you progress, there's ways to spend what are called requisition points, which allow you, you can then build up your list points. So you can go from 1,000 and essentially increase it by 200 points every step of the way. The grand narrative approaches it as like an event weekend where you show up with a roster of 3,000, which I think is a great thing to do for an event because you can pick and choose how you want to go into 2,000 or 1,000.
Yeah, they peel off in the grand narrative. They peel off like you show up with this large force, and then it's like you've only got this bitch, or you got to focus. This elements of your army can be there, and you've based on the mission and what's happening.
That's right. That's right. Which is cool. I think having the side table allows for some dynamic approaches to the missions and also like how you're playing and whatnot. And it also allows you, you know, between battle scars and everything, you can kind of put certain focuses or emphasis on different parts of the army, which is fun. Very cool way to approach it. Yeah. And just to note, like you can level up just about everything except for epic heroes in Crusade. Those are the only ones, which, I mean, admittedly, most of them come pretty epic already. And so like, but there's something too I've found in a lot of ways, you know, taking your own character. I mean, we've talked about it before, right? Gazgul, Tycho, Mephiston, a lot of these characters, Brother Captain Stern. I know, I'm with you. Still one of my favorites, but that's how he, like, they came to be through like the old games, right? Like they rose up to the surface. And that's what I really appreciate about what you can kind of do with customizing your own characters and bringing them into the game, which is a lot of fun.
And Dante is 1,200 years old, but always improving.
That's right. That's right. Just cross that Rubicon. He's a boss now. If he wasn't a boss already.
So epic hero is kind of locked in, but also you're not necessarily, okay, well, I don't want to like put narrative players in anyone's one specific box or not, but like I know a lot of players play this to level up their units, to bring that personality, to add those, and not necessarily as drastic as like Necromunda, but like the battle scars, the purity seals, the honors and stuff, like those will make their way onto their model in some way.
Oh, for sure, for sure. Yeah, you'll see how people progress, and there's even you know, carry over from some of the older stuff. There's even a way to take a character when they fall to put them into Space Marines, to put them into a Dreadnought and do cool stuff like that. So there's that progression. I tell you what, the Blood Angels, their Crusade stuff. Again, I love the like character that they add with a lot of the Crusade stuff for the Blood Angels, just because I had to scratch that bingo card. The Death Company, so it's really cool. They like get stronger as they get more battle scars, and it becomes like the objective to like make them go Super Saiyan to get these battle scars. But then when any unit gets 3 battle scars, it's gone forever. Like that's, you know, that's the general rule. You could house rule it, play it differently if you wanted, but like once Death Company get three battle scars, they're dead. But it's cool because they're like pushing their way to it. Like they want to get more battle scars, which is a very interesting dynamic. Very, very, very narrative flavored.
So what's the big standout stuff here for the Nachman Gauntlet? Like what is, how is this advancing the, either the tactics or the storyline?
So tactically or mechanically, there's three big things, but storyline, really want to hit up that. So, you know, we had Leviathan, which is clearly monsters, you know, Tyranid versus Space Marines and all of that that goes with it. We had the Pariah Nexus, which we're all familiar. You know, we've seen the shift from 7th edition into 8th edition, 9th edition, and the Necrons and everything that's going on there. And then now we're to the Nachman Gauntlet, and this is like Vigilus. This is the push of Harkin Worldclaimer, who's back at it, and he's bringing
glad he's on the scene again.
Chaos. That's right. That's right. Well, and you know, it's cool. They have pages breaking down the Planet Killers back from the 12th Black Crusade from the Gothic War. And so there's some cool stuff like how they show it all, and they've got a really good schematic of it. But so that's kind of where we're at story wise. And that's where it brings in the Sisters of Battle, and there's a whole, they do a great job of laying out all the forces. I always have a fun time capturing like the narrative scale of it and what they're talking about. Cause like on the chaos side, as it lays it out, I mean, there's over 100, you know, ships involved in this, just fleet alone of enormous size. And so the amount of Chaos Space Marines that are invested in this is pretty gigantic as well. So anyways, just really cool kind of background to the Nachman Gauntlet and what the kind of forces of the Black Legion are up to. And there's a whole range of teams that have allied with it. They lay it out. There's World Eaters, there's Emperor's Children, you know, and that we've all seen where Fulgrim is, right? Like, I mean, there's all sorts of things lining into it. There's Word Bearers, there's Night Lords, obviously, like I was talking about. Very, really cool stuff. And so it's kind of exciting to see it all. But as the mechanics go, so three big mechanics here. Cool thing is for these missions, for the Nachman Gauntlet missions, they have this tactical reserves. And so it's a specific way in which you will muster your crusade army for these. Now, that's not saying you absolutely have to, but it's just a fun way to play into the narrative of these kinds of missions specifically. And the missions, the deployment zones are wild for some of these just because of how you phase into it. It's kind of crazy. Like there's no... When you look at some of them, it's not about balance. It's about someone's attacking, someone's definitively defending their position. And then the way this works with this tactical reserves is that you choose a formation stance. So, for example, at 2,000 points in a strike force game, you have three stances. You can choose alpha, beta, gamma. And one's 900 points, one's 1,000 points, one's 1,100 points. So you start with that primary wave of that on the table. Now, Paul, you might choose gamma. I might choose alpha. So I only start with 900 and you start with 1,100. But then in turn two and turn three, you get a reinforcement wave. And so I'll get 550 points in turn two and turn three that'll come in, and you'll get 450 points turn two and turn three. And so it's just a matter of kind of how you want to phase your forces in out of whatever you've got, you know, that makes up that 2,000 points. And so it's a cool little thing like that. Now to build off of that, and there's a whole, you know, that there's a little bit more to it. I'm kind of catching the high point. And they do a good job of breaking down, like, what does a primary wave look like? What is a reinforcement wave one? They give some examples of, like, how you might go about breaking that down. You know, making sure you've got the right level of infantry to secure objectives up front or something like that versus the reinforcement waves of vehicles that's going to handle whatever.
And the game walks you through this. Like it tells you
it does
how to do this 100%. And like gives you a good example in right in the book of how to lay out your wave 1, 2, 3 and forces, the operational thing they're doing. And I think what the points that they are as well.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. 100%. And then so just some quick, you know, where people are like, is some of the stuff, so you can't use a rapid ingress strategy. So like that's one of the things they kind of take off the table as they impose these other structures or mechanics to it. And then the next part is this surgical deep strike, which I'm super excited about. This is the next big mechanic because this takes me back, again, having just played 30K and gone through some of the things that are 30K's, you know, seventh edition 0.5, if you want to call it that. So surgical deep strike feels a lot like deep striking back in the previous editions. You don't just come in at 9 inches. So you can come in horizontally away 3 inches because acknowledging that Crusade doesn't necessarily follow all of the match play rules. But then essentially it goes into this score that to do so, you roll 2d6, subtracting 1 from the result for each enemy model that is within 9 inches. And then you go over to the test. And it's, I mean, so if it's a 4 or higher on this roll, your unit can act normally this turn. If it's a 3 or higher, your unit has to take a battle shock test. 2 or higher, you're off balance, which means you just start battle shocked. And then if it's a 1 or less, your unit suffers a deep strike mishap where you roll a d6 onto the next table. Right? We're back to mishaps. And so, like, I mean, disaster. If you roll a 6 on the deep strike mishap, it's a disaster. Your unit suffers d6 mortal wounds, is battle shocked until the end of the turn. It's not eligible to shoot or declare a charge. And so, again, I think it's just cool. I think it's just this added stuff to, like,
I think it was great that you highlighted that the match play rule set that we play as just the way 40K is an overlay to the rules.
Right.
Which is, it defines certain things to round out that kind of competitive side of things to make it a truly balanced thing on one side or the other. Where in a Crusade or narrative game, the inherent balance of both sides of the table can be, I don't want to say discarded, but it's a little fuzzy sometimes based on whatever scenario is.
That's right.
Yeah, it's almost like a patch fixing a game. You know how we've had game like video games like Warcraft 3 that was patched to become Dota, which became its own genre of gaming. It's almost like they got 40K and then they put the competitive match play patch on it to make it function in that way, and then they put the RP more fluff-based Crusade patch on it to make it function that way, which I think is really clever. And I love describing it like that because a lot of people out there are gamers in our nerddoms and that clicks with them.
Yeah, for sure. And so that's those are the two big ones. The third one, which is very much narrative, they added in this, which I was really excited to see this adjustment, beyond the missions, well, it's actually above that, but the missions are crazy. Just throwing that out there. I mean, some of them, like if you scroll down, some of the deployments, you know, through the book are like you're on top of each other. And especially because of how you're deploying and how you come in. I mean, a 2,000-point game, you start with 900 to 1,100 points on the table. So, like, the battlefield is a lot more open than you might think, but the deployment zones are still on top of each other. And then think, you know, where that negative space starts to fill out as those reinforcement waves come in, the missions are crazy. But so the other awesome part to this is that they added in strategic asset paths. So in previous, you know, in Pariah Nexus, they had like Blackstone and you would collect Blackstone and it essentially became another currency beside like your experience and everything. You could buy traits, you could buy relics, you could buy all sorts of stuff with it. However, like super excited for this new path or this new way of playing where essentially, okay, let's say they do a good job. They show an example of the Nachman Crusade. They have 4 different strategic sites. And then for every battle that is won, you gain points that then contribute to the overall control of those strategic sites. And then once you control that site more than someone else, your faction, you know, people, whoever that are playing on one side will get a bonus for that. And so you move beyond, you know, back to your point, Paul, is really good, you know, depiction of it. Outside of just the tactical games that you're playing, you're moving to this broader scope of, you know, these strategic sites and what they actually mean to control them. And I think that adds a lot of fun opportunities for how you kind of paint the battlefield and why you're fighting over this place and what it does for this or that. And it's cool. And again, like, you know, if you could come up with your own, and they give some good examples of kind of how to build off of, but you can also just play straight out of the book and just go with those and roll with it, which I think is pretty exciting. So it's pretty cool to have some kind of, you know, regions or narrative environments that you're fighting over that then give bonuses and things like that.
There you go. Well, if you got some folks looking to scratch that itch, there's going to be a nice time to jump into it, get us in your hands. I think next weekend, by the time people are hearing this, the weekend after, you could actually have it in the hands in the stores. And if you are looking for a break from the tournament missions, it's a great way to get your figures on the table. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back to go listen to a word from our sponsors, and then we'll see you on them.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games, Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hello, everyone. We are back. Thank you very much for checking out our sponsors and doing all the stuff for us as well. You know, subscribe. New here. Subscribing would be great. Leave some comments down below. Doing the likes, all that kind of stuff. Let the aggregators know that there's something we're doing over here on this channel. That other maybe others as well. 5-star reviews go a long way. Tanya, you've been working. So we heard on the last episode, we heard yep. what you're planning with your guard. Sorry, Astra Militarum, old habits, die hard. But you're basically creating your whole like regiment.
Yes.
Of you know mixed.
The command structure.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And you also been you know working on some new units to add in there. So you know want to hear more about that.
All right. So one of the things in the spreadsheet was that certain. Groups were color coded, right? And the color code does correspond to the color of the actual models inside of that particular section. So what I've been doing is I'm going back to my old guard scheme, which was really quite boring because it was just kind of dark green and neutral gray.
That
and there's like nothing.
Guard color schemes. I mean, not executed as well, but like that was back in the day. That was basically like. You know, what are you going to put over Caliban Green as your, horse, you know?
Yeah. And so, you know, I started painting that army years ago, and I feel like I've progressed a lot as a miniature painter. And part of my style now is having sort of contrasting colors within my models. And so I'm revisiting a lot of my old models, and I'm putting a little bit of burgundy and ochre, sort of ochre yellow on in order to create a little bit of contrast within the color scheme, and I love it. It's great. And so my Death Corps are mostly the kind of burgundy color. My Cadians are mostly gray, and I've sort of got these ideas sort of percolating throughout the army, but I needed to paint some Rattlings because I've been bringing them to every game and having a lot of fun with them. And I had the old metal models. I love painting metal models. So I had to somehow incorporate all of those colors into these little fellas. But at the same time, their particular section, the main color is actually black. On them, right? So they're in a little section with Gaunt's ghosts. I sort of see them sort of running around sort of together in camp in there. And Gaunt's ghosts, I've painted them black, mostly black. And then their capes, I wanted to sort of paint them like camellia lines. So they're kind of painted to match the bases a little bit. I start off all models by painting the skin tone. So painted the skin tone first, and then I did black fatigues. I guess I don't. What are they wearing?
Yeah. No, we'll go with fatigues. That's good. That's a good call.
Okay. He's got the technical term. He's just waiting to drop on you later. That's right.
Yeah. Better than me, Tanya.
It looks like a t-shirt and sweatpants. Like I'm not gonna lie. And then I started to. Pick out some of the colors that are in my army. So their guns are like the green that is on the armor of almost all of my other miniatures. And they've got these like sort of wraps. Some of them have wraps around their arms and some of them have them around their feet. So those are the burgundy color of my Death Corps overcloaks, great cloaks, and all of the insignias with the Aquila and everything is done in the ochre color. But one of the coolest things that I did with this guy, there's one guy who has a cloak, because these are the old metal models. So there's one fella that has a cloak. And so I painted it exactly like how I painted my Gaunt's Ghosts cloaks to sort of match the basing. And so now in the storyline, he's just the best thief of them all because he stole one of the cloaks from Gaunt's Ghosts. So, yeah, that's kind of how I approach bringing all the models together when you've got a unit that's kind of a little bit crazy.
When you were choosing the color of their uniforms, fatigues, or whatever, mm-hmm. did you assign them to that unit and then just have to apply the scheme that you chose for that section of the regiment to them? Or did you assign them to them because you had chosen to already paint them that way?
No, I painted them black because of where they are in my little organizational spreadsheet. Everybody else that's going into that little section, they're going to have black as their main color.
There were no wrong answers, by the way. Just curious as to how the choice with choice was made. As we know,
that's how that choice was made.
Yeah, we create these traps for ourselves, you know, it's like of needing to do something because that's just the way we decided it was going to happen.
But see, I actually like the way that this is because sometimes I get decision, often I get decision fatigue. So if I can just go to the spreadsheet and be like, oh, they're there, it's black, I don't have to make the decision. It's just one less thing that I have to think about, and I can just go into turn off the brain mode and just paint.
I like that. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And it's, you're speaking of tricks and stuff, you know, like getting a unit on the table, finishing out your dream to fruition and that kind of stuff. Like sometimes you gotta kind of revert back in, you know, the, I don't say autopilot, but you know, you front loaded some of the decision-making. So mm-hmm. you have to do less later on. And so it's theoretically, if that's the way that everything's wired, you get it done easier for what you're trying to do.
Yeah, I always do one model. Like if I'm assembly lining, right, because I just finished doing 30 Death Corps of Krieg in one batch. So I will do one model to completion so that I just know in my head what the next step is. And then for the 29 other ones, I just do all of the steps. And then eventually they're all done and I can put them on the shelf.
I like that.
It gets it done.
Mm-hmm.
I do like that. Well, thanks for sharing that with us. I mean, there's a lot there, like cool scheme, cool lore, paint practices, you know, how to macro get an army, you know, from basically the sprue in your vision to the tabletop. So thank you.
Yeah. And then one more thing. I know we've been talking a lot about me not being able to continue on the Horus Heresy because I've been missing a few. But one of our lovely listeners, Jason Ford, sent me two. The next two that I need. So I started reading Angel Exterminatus. I'm very excited. And I also have Betrayer waiting for me as well. So thank you so much, Jason. Thank you for the nice note and also the basing bits as well. You are the GOAT.
One of my favorite characters in the entire series. I think their first appearance is in Angel Exterminatus.
Ooh.
Yeah. And it's not a Primarch or anything like that. It's just like it's a Space Marine. He's pretty.
Is his cool. armor red?
No, it's not.
Oh, no. Okay, interesting. Yeah.
But there's some cool battles. Maybe it's not the first. Maybe it's his second appearance. I can't remember when this character. Well, I don't want to spoil anything if you haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah, please, no spoilers. Yeah. But also, I'm a huge Graham McNeil fan, so I'm very, very looking forward to this one.
Yeah, this is a good one.
Graham is also cool people. You can bump into him at some of these cons. He's a gamer. He likes to get out there and he plays and paints Ultramarines and that kind of stuff. Like he's.
Mm-hmm. I had the joy of talking to him after I had just finished Storm of Iron. And he's just so super down to earth and like super chill and willing to talk to all the nerd fans about all the nerdy stuff. Yeah.
It's pretty cool when that happens. It's not, you know, they're actually living the life, you know, kind of thing and putting it on the paper.
Yeah.
But you know, and thanks for, yeah, reaching out, listener, and getting those books in because, you know, some of those things are hard to find. So I really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
You know, talking a little bit more about the Eldaris, are going to make a ripple here. Like this is the first weekend that they'll probably be in people's hands.
I was going to reach out to show my faction dice. They came in the mail a couple days ago. Looking forward to rolling them. And I think they're going to make a splash in the meta. It's absolutely going to make a splash. And so instead of talking more about, you know, what I'm planning to take and how just I wish there was about 300 more points in this list that I could use. So where you struggle, I shouldn't say where you struggle. There's lots of good stuff, but there's, you know, you've got to take this balance of how do I want to score objectives? How do I want to keep people off of me? Because you are a bunch of one toughness three. Again, you got invulnerable saves and a lot of stuff, but still easy to wound. Having, you know, weighted dice can bring you down. So you got to have stuff in your list that still plays the game, blocks out deployment zones, set screens, and that kind of stuff. And so it's a little tricky, but somebody's going to figure it out, and they're going to bring that lethality to the table. So how are other armies going to adapt?
It's a great question. It is the $1 million question in the meta at the moment. It's for the main question is, then the issue is it's so hard to answer this question. It's because there's so many superstar detachments out of this. There are so many different ways to play this faction effectively and brutally. So people aren't quite sure what's going to settle as the best. Some people are already saying Yunari is likely to be the best one after a couple of weeks and or months, but it looks like
one. Yunari get a lot of rules. It's like you get a lot of the same rules plus, you know, and then they got that extra, you know, the thing they flavor on top of being able to bring in different, you know, Drukhari.
But it's the hardest one to wield, as in it's the hardest one. It's got the biggest skill ceiling on it because you need to get your stuff dead. Your army doesn't work if your stuff ain't dying. And how do you tempo that out? How do you control that? How do you mitigate that? And how do you stop your opponent from just being like, well, I'm going to plan to kill 3 to 4 of all of these 5 model units. And then your army doesn't have any rules. And so you've got to combat that as well. But the first things people are really keen about is, firstly, everyone wants to play Aspect Host. I don't know of an Eldari player that isn't excited to play with their Aspect Warriors again.
You can use your collection
en masse.
If you've had a long time collection of one or two, you know, squads of whatever Aspect Warriors were your favorite flavor, they make their way into
them. There are no bad Aspect Warriors. I'm convinced there are no bad Aspect Warriors. There are some less good Phoenix Lords, but there are no untakeable Aspect Warriors. You could play a list with one of each Aspect Warrior, and it's going to be a good list.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, it's not going to be the best list, but it's going to be like, wow, I don't feel like a fool.
You'll score for points. Doing this. You'll take out your opponent's units or whatever. Okay, so, people are going to play for Aspect.
Correct. You'll have some dynamic movement in Wolf Spiders and Sweeping Hawks. You will have some melee in Scorpions and Banshees. You'll have some Daka in Fire Dragons and Dark Reapers. And you'll have a little bit of everything with the Shining Spear. It's actually kind of cool. It kind of works. It's a bit absurd. But the interplay to a lot of this, so one of the first things people have identified is that there's quite a few little abilities in the game that function like Overwatch, but aren't Overwatch. So the battle focus agile maneuver specifically denotes they ignore the Overwatch stratagem. So there are a couple of things that let you shoot as if it was Overwatch, but it's not the Overwatch stratagem. Imperial Knights have one of these in their new Forge Pact detachment, Grotmas detachment, where you can pay a CP and shoot with exactly one of your guns that hit on sixes. You know, you could just take a big old flamey flame and dead. And there's a couple of other things like
on
that.
The Valiant?
Too. Those are incredibly good places to start with your Eldar counterplay. In addition, they do have a couple of detachments that do like to do some shenanigans from reserve, in addition to stuff like the Yinkan possibly as well. So your Infiltrator, you know, the 12-inch denial bubbles are pretty good also. The Windrider host that is going to be, I don't expect it to be the best one because while I do think it has the biggest damage ceiling of any of them, it also has it's got the biggest glass cannon effect of the army. Like if things go wrong, your army will just cease to be there. But if things are going well, you're going to take your opponent in 2, 3 or 4 turns. They're just going to be gone. So you want to be able to apply pressure to them early. And also there are quite a few of their builds that don't necessarily function against lone operatives very effectively. And then the things that they need to use to kill lone operatives, such as Fire Dragons, such as Dark Reapers. Well, Dark Reapers aren't very good. They're going to be long range. But things like Fire Dragons, who can get in close out of a Web Serpent and stuff, a lot of the time you're okay trading a medium-costed lone operative for these assets. Like if you were to trade out your, say, Kalidus Assassin, jumps over, gets like a area denial or a couple of points on in a secondary or established locus, something like that, and then they die in exchange for 5 fire dragons, well, you're kind of okay with that in these terms, because the upside for what that unit can do for them is exponentially larger than a lot of time what a single lineup will do for you, especially if you're wheeling stuff like lictors and things like that, really cheap, like well-rounded lineups. These things are very good against Eldar. They can be very frustrating and active and cause them a bit of activation paralysis, so to speak, because they're going to have so many instances of 5 things shooting, and then they're going to have a couple of big 10 model units that are going to have very specific things that they do.
2 of their units to 1 thing of yours because you've got it pushed in there, then one Correct. Unit is exposed because it doesn't have the same battle focus Yes. as the other.
And you want to stress them out on under and over commitments of resources. So, of course, 5 fire dragons fully supported will kill most tanks in the game. That's fine. That's always going to happen. But 5 fire dragons don't kill something that don't kill 5 models that have a 4-up invulnerable save or a 5-up invulnerable save. You know, it's only 5 shots. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you have a 5-up invulnerable save, they got to hit with everyone, wound with everyone. You got to fail every 5-up. It's not going to happen. Or should, you know. Now that I've said it, it's just going to be, I'm going to get hate mail.
Of course, like,
it happened 4 times.
You promised me I wouldn't lose these Terminators. And I just painted them.
But, correct. There is a phenomenal amount of strong AP abilities in here. It's very similar to Astra Militarum as well, as in, you know, via a couple of different stratagems and a couple of different attachments and a Warwalker, they can get to AP 4 or more with ability to have Ignores cover from Shroud Runners. So, in like, considering your armor save is like kind of, they have the ability to remove your armor save, that means the importance of invulnerable save goes up exponentially. So getting more invulns in your army as well. They don't deal a crazy amount of mortal wounds outside of a couple of different detachments.
That's actually kind of the balance, I think, in this list, in the Eldarian generals, that they got a lot more tricks in exchange for the mortal wound. So that's something to consider if you were fighting Eldari before. The threat is coming from a different place now.
So their mortal wound dealing asset is Azamun, getting dev wounds once per game, and he'll just wipe a squad once per game. You're just going to have to eat that. And grenades is pretty much the only 2 places that are going to be consistent assets for mortal wound generation. So I have to worry about mortals too much. Invuln is like, Invuln and Feel No Pain are the 2 defensive metrics you want to try and get good. You want to try and build into your armies. And it doesn't necessarily need to say like, oh, well, now I've got to go play demons instead of playing, you know, whatever you're playing before. But just try and get like 1 or 2 like decent assets that have an invulnerable save. Like Vanguard Veterans might be a way to go for Astartes at the moment, or Blade Guard. Because, I mean, in all honesty, like I've got Inner Circle Companions. They're essentially Blade Guard that punch a little bit harder, but don't have the 4-up. I don't need to punch harder into Eldar. If I hit them with an assault intercessor, they're dead. So I don't need to be super, super damage outputty. I just need to change the metrics of durability I'm operating on. So don't try and front load all this damage, all this stuff. You don't need it. Now, Eldar is really easy to kill. The biggest struggle is getting in line of sight of them. So you want dynamics, and then you want resilience in, like I said, the form of invulns and feel no pains, rather than trying to rely on an armor save.
Thanks for coming to
my TED talk.
Yeah. So what about trying to fight the mobility? You know, so, and look, you've also mentioned several multi-unit combos, and so taking a piece of that combo out is going to, you know, by 16%, you know, 17 to sometimes 33% change the effectiveness of the Eldar combo. And so having that conversation with your opponent of like, what does that thing do? Like, if you see, let me just, this is the tip, if you see a Warwalker, a Viper, you know, those are things like you're going to ask them, what do those do? Like, ask what their utility pieces. So ask them why they are in their list, what they're doing. You put them on your threat priority list. Don't discount them because you have some preconceived notions about what that vehicle is or what it's for. These are now kind of pieces that they line up to make 2 and 3 in a combo.
Correct. So there is, outside of Dark Reapers and Fire Dragons, ranged-wise, their range damage output isn't going to be ultra significant. Like they're not going to kill like Land Raiders from long range very consistently, if at all. They're going to have to do that by committee, by death by 1,000 cuts. So actual traditional Overwatch is still a value here. Because outside Fire Dragons, there's nothing that's going to kill a tank one shot. There's like outside Fire Dragons and Dark Reapers, nothing's going to one shot a tank, essentially. So that means multiple assets, which means it gives you the option to overwatch something. So building in
damage 3, by the way, I just want to put this. There are a few things that can
You want to stress their activations and stress their abilities. That's... Make them use all of them all the time and make them constantly have to use their brain, because that's when you'll make them slip up and maybe you'll pick up a unit or two or five something or others when they didn't think you could. But yeah, you talked about mobility. So, of course, Vantage Charge is a big deal here. Trying to close on them before they close on you. Of course, we know Eldar. One of their biggest weaknesses is they don't have a lot of OC. They don't have a lot of ways to hold primary consistently. What they're predominantly going to be doing, unless things dramatically change that I haven't noticed, is scoring every secondary card that comes off the top of the deck. They will just score. They're just going to have the ability to get it on demand.
Because they can move, secondly, like, they're capable of very fast movement. They're never out of scoring range.
Correct. And they're going to be able to deny your primary very effectively. Now, you can combat that in two ways. You can try and put things on your objectives that are ultra durable and are going to survive them and cause, like I said, a constant overinvestment of resources by them. Or you can go and contest their primary. I'm much more like the go and contest their primary option. Go and contest them, pressure them in their deployment zone on their side of the table, and mess around with their plans a little bit. Put them under stress. Because if you just sit back and tit for tat trading game versus Eldar, nine times out of ten, I think most armies in the game, maybe outside Guard and some very skewed Orcs or Necron builds, I think just so definitely want to go and be proactive with things. So advancing and charging, infiltrating or scouting, and things that usually can either go through walls or if they're going around walls can advance and charge.
I say fight first, invulnerable save infantry.
Yep,
might be really helpful.
I agree. They have Jainzar, of course, and Howling Banshees, of course. One thing I'll say about Howling Banshees, they hit on twos and they wound infantry on twos. Infantry on twos. What I just said about bikes, things that have to go around walls, thunderwolves, bikes, swarms, beasts, not infantry. You actually don't have to worry about them too much. Of course, Jainzar will beat you up, but the actual Banshees and Scorpions aren't that good into these things. So if you can play an off infantry build, and they're taking a bunch of Banshees and stuff like that, you're kind of fine. They're strength 4 AP 2-2 damage. It's like actually pretty manageable for a lot of things that usually, you know, like you talk about a fiend being a beast. Only toughness 4, but 4 wounds, and they're going to wound it on 4s. They're going to hit on 2s, wound on 4s, into a 4-up invulnerable save. Every 2 wounds go through to kill a beast. Pretty good returns. Like, and you only need like 2 beasts to kill the 5 Banshees on the hit back. So they can go in and kill like 4 of them if they want. Unless they have Jainzar there, you're gonna scoop up the 5 Banshees on the return. Nice. So,
well, I mean, know thy enemy. You know, that's kind of the
it's correct. It's half the fight, or whatever percentage red says of the fight. It's at least half, right?
So
is it like 53.7% or something specific?
I think a lot of Eldar players are gonna go wide. Like Eldari lists are gonna be wide with like one or two units that they cover everything. You're going to have a couple of shooting units, you're going to have a couple of fighting units, you're going to have a couple of movies units.
What do most people do when they get a new book? They get what they were most recently playing and they adapt it into. So expect people to be playing with much the similar archetypes, which was MSU value, like small sized units and lots of them, and expect that to translate directly into the codex for the, you know, probably first, you know, month to 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And then we'll start seeing some iterations starting to pick up and see what happens from there.
If you show up and across the table, it's 3 units of Howling Banshees and 3 units of Striking Scorpions, well, you know, that's how you have to play that game.
You know? Be a Thunderwolf. Seriously, be a Thunderwolf. Invuln, not infantry, can get right up in their face immediately. I got to say, Thundercav versus like all the Eldar combat feels incredible.
Good point. That is our show this week. I know we've kind of jumped around through the different topics, but you know, I think it's important to highlight the different modes of play sometimes. And then also, you know, we all got to get our models on the table. So whatever it takes, the motivation to get us there. And it's cool to have a project like that. And then the Eldari are going to shake things up. There is a very diverse meta out there. And I'm talking, what I mean by that is, you know, we do a show also called the Warhammer Messers, which we look at top 10s from around the globe. And in the top 10s, there's like 8 different factions in most events out there. I feel like when you get a codex like the Eldari dropped in, that it's going to warp a little bit of that to see, you know, I'm curious to see what other generals think are going to be the top things. Or is there depth in those indexes and codexes to adapt to this? It'd be fun to watch. And basically, two codexes dropping almost at the same time into the meta with Realm Terra
and it's a brewer's paradise out there at the moment. But that's our show this week. Been a fun ride. Really appreciate everybody tuning in. Do not forget to leave us those 5-star reviews, and we'll see y'all next week, everybody. Have a great night.
Bye, everybody.
Scan is clear. I think they're gone for now.